Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brawley, your host for the next hour and a half here on the radio show and podcast that aims to get you thinking, that brings Christians and non-Christians together. It's unbelievable, this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. And don't forget, you can find us online with links to past shows and lots of other features and resources and videos at premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. Links there, of course, to our Facebook and Twitter accounts as well. You can find me at UnbelievableJB on Twitter and Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to find and like the Facebook page. This is all about getting Christians and non-Christians talking, defending the Christian worldview by open discussion and dialogue. And so that's exactly what we're doing on today's show. I'm going to be introducing my guests, John Loftus and Randall Rouser, in just a moment's time. Just a reminder, though, that if you were at Unbelievable, the conference 2013 a few weeks ago, or couldn't make it there, don't forget we are going to be releasing the videos online shortly. So stay tuned for more on how you can get hold of those a little later on in the month. And don't forget also that later on in the show we'll hear your feedback as well. Lots of people get in touch with me every week. I never have enough time to read all of them out, but I'll try and give a fair smattering of what you've sent in the last week later on in the show. That's all to come. Today, though, on the programme, we're looking at the question and the book, God or Godless? An atheist and a Christian join me to discuss the issues here on the show, Unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
So it's great to welcome onto the show today my two guests, Randall Rouser and John Loftus, and we're going to be finding out a little bit more about them now and the books that they've both been writing recently. First of all, a warm welcome to you, Randall, back again after you joined us earlier in the year to talk about your last book, The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver and Other Apologetic Rabbit Trails. You've been doing some debates recently, I understand, with John. So tell us a little bit about that and how that all ties into your latest book that you've authored with him.
It's sort of an interesting thing. You know, I contacted John about 4 years ago to do a book of debates that became God or Godless, but we'd never met or even talked on the phone. I started thinking, you know, now that the book's coming out, it would be time to meet. So I invited him to come on up here to Alberta, and we set up 3 dates in Alberta, Canada, and we've been having these debates at churches and having a good time and getting into the thick of some of the debates that we've been written a book about.
It's called God or Godless, and it's a really interesting idea. One atheist, one Christian, 20 controversial questions. It's like a whole set of mini debates, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, we wanted to distinguish this book in the field from other debating books. A lot of other books will have one big question, like, does God exist or did Jesus rise from the dead? We wanted to cover a whole panoply of issues, many of which often don't get addressed in books like this, and that was the idea that we had with the 20 short debates.
So how have you guys gotten on in the debates that you've had? Do you find that debates are a good way of actually bringing some of these issues to the fore? Some people don't like the idea of a debate format. They think it's more about point scoring than really getting to the truth of the matter.
Well, they're fun and they're entertaining. They don't always get to the truth, but they do introduce people to different ideas, and you know, that's a good thing. It can only help further the discussion, you know. So, yeah, they're enjoyable.
This is John I'm talking to now, of course. John, you're a former Christian minister yourself. You've been on the show a long time back now, I seem to remember. But for those who perhaps aren't familiar with who you are, just do you want to just give us a brief synopsis of how you got to be doing what you're currently doing?
Well, I backed into it. I didn't really plan on it. I just was asked a lot of times by some of my former parishioners why I became an atheist, and I thought I'd write a book about it and sell it in a local bookstore and for the people who might want to know. And so then I did that, but it also went online and it got some attention. So Sartre talks about being condemned to be free. It looks like I'm condemned to debate Christianity.
I mean, you're interesting as well, because you've come, as it were, right from the point of being at one time a thoroughgoing Christian apologist. So in many ways, you know these arguments like the back of your hand, right?
Well, I feel that way, yeah. I haven't heard anything in the last 7 years that was anything important that I may have missed in my rejection of Christianity, I'll tell you that.
And what was it that brought you to the point of having, believed the arguments that you now critique? What was the defining moment that made you decide that all of them really didn't hold water, even though you had at one time believed they did?
Well, there's no one defining moment. It took me 12 years to leave the faith and become an atheist. I went through various stages from a conservative to a moderate to a liberal to a deist to an agnostic to an atheist. And it took a long time of thinking out this issue and that issue. But basically the bottom line is, I just started examining my own faith, by the same standards that I evaluated all the other faiths that I rejected. That's probably the best way to describe it.
Well, let's come to you, Randall, again, just before we get into the first question that we're looking at today on the so-called outsider test for faith that John has developed. What for you is the value of going up against someone like John, both in the book and in person, when it comes to these questions that divide Christians and atheists?
Well, one thing that is valuable in terms of this kind of dialogue is people always think when you write a book like this or you deliver a talk on it, yeah, but what would the other guy say? What would the other side say? So when you write a book or deliver a talk that has the other guy on the other side there, that immediately gives people a better sense that they're getting a fuller picture of things. Now, I think there's a lot of value in debates, but I also think we need to be aware that sometimes debating can set people up just to be retrenched in their positions. Psychologists have noted that there's this phenomenon called kickback, where people can become more certain of their positions when they're presented with evidence against their positions. And something we all have to be aware of, that we're all reluctant to change our opinions, and sometimes debates can simply retrench people. But if people are open, if they're rational, if they're willing to think critically about the issues, a debate is a great way to present the issues and get people thinking broadly about them.
Well, that's kind of what we aim to do on this show, as you know, Randall, get people discussing, debating the issues, not quite in the sort of very precise timed format. It's more of obviously a discussion, and that's what we'll be doing today on the show, as we aim to look at two issues that have emerged recently from both of your writings. The Outsider Test for Faith is John's most recent book that he's penned. How to Know Which Religion is True is the subtitle. And of course, the one you've written together, God or Godless, which covers a whole variety of issues. And I think in many ways, the Outsider Test for Faith touches on a number of these issues when you get into it. Let's allow John, though, first of all, if you would, to tell us about this test you've developed, what it's about, as briefly as you can, to give us an idea of why you then that it calls into question whether it's possible to rationally believe that Christianity is the one true faith, as it were.
I'm not exactly using the argument as a way of showing Christianity is wrong. I may have in the past, but I decided that a better way to think of it would be as a way to solve a problem. And the problem is religious diversity. I mean, we find a lot of it separated into geographical areas around the globe, and I think that that kind of problem needs a solution. That is, how can we decide between all of them which religion is true? And basically, the bottom line is that you should examine your own faith with the same standards that you use when you evaluate all other faiths, and see what you get. I mean, that's basically what it is. See what you get. See if it stands under the same scrutiny that you scrutinize other religions by. And then later on in the book, of course, I use it to show that Christianity doesn't pass that test. But the fact that I use it that way doesn't mean that it's biased, simply because I do, because G.K. Chesterton endorsed an outsider test for faith in The Everlasting Man, where he argued similarly, but not quite the same way I do, that you gotta look at your own faith from the outside. So how I use the test and how I think it how it judges Christianity is a separate issue from the test itself. But yeah, that's what it is. It's a way to solve a problem, and that is the problem of religious diversity and how to know which religion is true if there is one, right?
And you come down on the conclusion, essentially, that the diversity of religious belief is strongly suggestive that none of them are actually true. At best, only one of them can be true. But at worst, and this is the more likely scenario, none of them are true. That's your view.
Right. And, that's my conclusion. But, how I use the test, how I use it to judge, religions, is a separate issue from the test itself.
Let's come to Randall at this point. Randall, you're familiar with this outsider test for faith that John has developed and often written on and spoken on. What are some of your initial thoughts about it and the way he aims to test whether religions are rational and justifiable by adopting this outsider view that even a Christian must adopt of their own faith, as it were?
I'm sympathetic with the idea that we ought to be rational in our beliefs, that we ought to try to overcome our confirmation bias, which is the psychological penchant each human being has to consider evidence in favor of their views and dismiss evidence that goes against their views, as well as motivated reasoning, where each human being attempts to place a special effort to seek evidence for their views and, again, not to seek evidence against their views. So I think that's great, that we need to be doing that. My problem probably with John's outsider test is that it doesn't go far enough, that it presents something called faith, which John treats to be as roughly equivalent to religion, and then says, well, that's what we need to have an outsider test for. That's what we need to seek to be objective about. And my view is a little different. I think, no, we need to seek to be objective about everything. We need to seek to overcome our confirmation biases, our irrationalities about everything. We need to seek to be as fair and reasonable in all our beliefs, not only some beliefs. And in the background here as well, there's the whole question of how one even defines religion such that one knows what things one is supposed to apply this test to. If one is a devoted nationalist and that's what they live for, then does that mean, well, that's what they apply the test to? If a person is a communist and they're committed to the Communist Party for life, is that what they apply the test to? I think rather than get into an endless morass of debate about what religion is and what things you apply this test to, we ought to just strive to be objective and reasonable and fair in all our beliefs and in all our reasoning.
I suppose it raises that question of whether you can do this with all your beliefs, apply this kind of level of skepticism towards them, let's say. Because a lot of things, most people go through life with a set of beliefs which they won't necessarily have critically engaged with because they just don't have the time or energy to do that.
Well yeah, that's the point. I mean, especially when it comes to religion, but even political beliefs and moral beliefs. Culture has an overwhelming influence on what we think and believe, and we have to learn to be objective. And the problem is that with religion, I mean, usually, and not always, but usually, Christians are not willing to examine their faith. I mean, just ask the 9/11 suicide bombers whether or not they were critical of their own religion and whether or not they were really sure that their religion is true. And, the answer is obvious, yes, yes, yes. And then they flew planes into buildings. So what can get them to actually seriously consider that their faith is wrong? I mean, Randall would probably agree that the militant Muslims, are wrong, And so, but they don't see it. See, they don't see it at all. I mean, some of them would drop an atomic bomb on us if they wanted to. And that's why faith is dangerous. So how can we get them to see that their faith is wrong? And I think Randall would share with me the goal of trying to show them that their faith is wrong. And so I would think that if you want to get their attention like nothing else, you would simply say, well, just be consistent, have no double standards, and, you know, examine your own faith in the same manner you examine the faiths of others. And I would think Randall would embrace that kind of thing, but apparently not when it comes to his own faith.
Well, let's allow Randall to answer that. Is that are you essentially not applying the same standards to your Christian faith that you would expect to apply to the militant Islamic or whatever, Randall?
Well, John just sort of declares this. I mean, I'm just as interested to know how critical John is about his atheistic, naturalistic views. See, when he uses the term consistently faith or religion, I think what that seems to me to be is a rhetorical move to say, this is something you have to do, but because I don't have a faith or religion by my own definition, it's not something that applies to me. And I think that's a very dangerous place to be in, because then it can allow someone like John to become very lackadaisical about his own belief system and not be willing to critically engage with his own belief system. So that's why I think using a more neutral term like belief system and recognizing we all have a belief system, we all have a set of assumptions about the way the world is, and that all of us need to strive to be rational and fair in our belief systems. That's something that is upon all of our shoulders if we're really serious about truth. I mean, I wrote a book called You're Not As Crazy As I Think, which the whole point of the book was to challenge Christians, non-Christians, and everybody to seek to be rational and fair when you engage with other people, to try to understand where they're coming from. So do I do it perfectly? Certainly not. I mean, nobody is perfectly rational or fair, but this is a test that is an ongoing test of epistemic or belief virtue that applies to me, but it also applies to John.
So do you not believe John has applied his own test consistently to his own worldview then?
In my engagement with him, I don't think that he's willing to seriously consider the problems he has to defend his own worldview. Now, when I invited him to do a debate, the initial proposal I had actually was a little different. It was, hey, why don't we talk about three things that really trouble us with our worldview? And John, I wrote an article about this afterwards, so this isn't a surprise for him that I'll talk about it. But he responded in the email, well, I have no problems with my worldview. Well, I mean, fair enough. He's being honest. But that is worrisome to me. I think every worldview has significant lacunae, significant problems in trying to understand things. And if you can't see any problems, if there are nothing, no beliefs in your worldview, no issues that keep you up at night, then that could be a red flag that you're not being adequately introspective about your own beliefs.
I need to interject here. The issue, if I remember right, was what bothers me about my worldview. I mean, what is it that bothers me? And I'm interested in everything, and I don't have all the answers by far, and so I'm curious to know things like how did life originate, you know, and other kinds of questions like how the brain works. So I'm certainly interested in those issues, and I certainly, you know, don't have the answers, but I don't lay awake at night, you know, thinking, well, you know, I've got to have the right answers here. I'm willing to let science do its work, you know, and so on. So no, I'm not really bothered by anything. I don't lay awake at night worrying about them. That's what the issue really was, not whether or not I had any problems. I mean, I have a lot of problems figuring out things, but the thing about it here is that I'm not really making any claims. You know, that's the whole point of it. I'm not affirming anything. I'm not saying Jesus did this or didn't do that. What I'm saying is I'm not the one saying that Jesus was born of a virgin. You know, I'm not the one saying he rose from the dead. I'm not the one saying God exists either. I'm just saying, you know, I don't see enough evidence for it. And so, you know, that's all there is to it. And so, you know, to ask me, well, what about your beliefs on these issues? Well, you know, I don't have them. You know, I don't have them. That's the bottom line. I'm an atheist because I'm a non-believer.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's an interesting way you've defined that, John, and I'd just be interested in your thoughts on that, Randall, because obviously the way John sees his atheism is not in this, at all in the same way that you as a Christian have to defend various views, beliefs. John, it sounds like John is saying his atheism is the sort of default position when you don't have any beliefs, basically. Now, do you think that's a faulty definition?
Yeah, in fact, on the last time I was on your show, the question at issue there was the statement, "I just believe in one less God than you." Atheists often, and I hear John saying this, will say, "Hey, look, I believe in all the things you believe in. I just kick God out of the picture, so I have nothing to defend." But the fact is that when atheists get serious about developing a worldview or a consistent, kind of coherent belief system, they have to look out and explain, how am I going to account for some of the things one finds in the world? So, for instance, the existence of transcendent objective moral virtue, or the ability of the human mind to know the world. These are the kinds of basic questions an atheist has to wrestle with. Now, it's really interesting that last year, Thomas Nagel, who himself is among the world's leading atheists, wrote a little book called Mind and Cosmos, which is the culmination of 45 years of his thinking intellectually about how to develop a consistent atheistic worldview. And his conclusion in the book is that naturalism, which is the main philosophical framework in which atheism is defended today, has been a failure. He says the only two options left, as he can see it, are appeal to intention, which means God, or perhaps some sort of neo-Aristotelian teleology. Now, that means trying to look for some principles of direction inherent in creation that give a directedness, a purpose to creation, apart from there being a mind. Nagel is candid enough to concede that it may be that teleology, such as he is pursuing now, is not even coherent apart from a mind. So what he's left with is saying naturalism has failed, and maybe the only thing left is theism. Now, I think that is a mark of intellectual integrity, where there's an atheist who appreciates the depth of the challenge he has in defending his own worldview. What I'd like to hear from John is a recognition that it's not just that he believes in everything I do except for God, but rather that he has to explain through a worldview that doesn't appeal to a mind, a necessary agent behind things, how he accounts for things like objective moral value, how he accounts for things like human reason, and many other things that we talk about in the book and in our spoken debates.
Yeah, and this is something that comes up in various of the debates that are in the God or Godless book. I mean, let's leave that part to one side, because I think we can come back to that in the next section of the program. I mean, something that I think is at the core, though, of John's outsider test of faith is this fact of religious diversity in the world. And I think many people, whether they've sort of, looked at it in the depth that John has or not, acknowledge that can be difficult then for a Christian particularly to say, I have the truth, when there are so many people out there who claim to have the truth, who claim to have very different religious experiences. John, is this kind of, for you, a fundamental problem for Christians and people of any other faith, the fact that this diversity exists in the world today, that this doesn't cohere well with a God of Christianity, let's say, that he would allow this kind of religious diversity to exist?
Yeah, it's one of them. The problem of suffering is another. How you can actually believe that, a virgin gave birth to God incarnate 2,000 years ago, is another. So I have several, why God didn't communicate more clearly his revelation from the get-go, rather than to allow something called progressive revelation, which in my opinion is nothing but theological relativism, because what is true yesterday is not true today and won't be true in the future. So there's no really objective standard for theological reflection or morality as well either, because that changes. So there's lots of things I am concerned about here when it comes to religion. But yeah, religious diversity is the focus of the book and the Outsider Test for Faith. I mean, how do you account for the fact that people in different separate geographical locations believe with almost certainty that their faith is true? You don't find that among scientists. That's the problem. I mean, not real scientists who adopt the standards of the scientific method. And the Christian can do is respond by saying, well, what's the scientific method? Or try to poke pinpricks of doubt in it and use that possibility as a way to overthrow the overwhelming probability that science knows what it's doing. The consensus of science is sure. So, the problem of religious diversity, how can we solve it in the light of 9/11? I mean, that's a serious problem. And, you know, you can't just say to the Muslim world, hey, you got to critically reflect on your faith, which is, I think, what Randall is trying to say and what others have said in criticism of the outsider test of faith. We'd have to give them a standard. And so this, I think, is the best self-diagnostic kind of test to get people to actually think about their faith. And I don't know why he would be against that sort of thing when it came to militant Muslims, but or why he'd be for it when it comes to Muslims, but against it when it comes to his own faith.
Okay, well, we're going to come back to these questions in a moment's time. Time to take a quick break now, though, and we'll be back continuing to discuss the outsider test for faith. Also, the question of miracles we're going to be looking at. That's another question that's raised in one of the chapters in God or Godless. And so Randall Rouser and John Loftus back with me in a moment's time, continuing to discuss atheism versus Christianity here on the show that does that kind of every week in one way or another. Unbelievable. With me, Justin Brierley, we'll be back in a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show with me, Justin Brierley. And today we're asking, God or Godless? That is the title of the new book by Randall Rouser, who's a Christian, and John Loftus, who's an atheist. And we're discussing some of the issues arising from the book today. Okay, coming back to finish off this talk about the outsider test for faith, this issue of religious diversity, how do you as a Christian cope with that then, Randall? The fact that, as John says in his book, it appears that most people inherit their religious beliefs depending on their locality, what their parents believe and so on, and very little often critical analysis is made of whether those beliefs are true or not, and yet people believe them firmly. Is this a problem, that this is the way faith appears to be diversified around the world?
Yeah, there are a lot of issues here. Let me first say that John likes to say, well, Randall likes to apply this test of mine to other people, but not himself. On the contrary, I said, these are epistemic virtues that we need to be applying to ourselves all the time. Like I said, I just don't think his test goes far enough. Now, in terms of the issue of religious diversity, I mean, this is something that, or the geographic distribution of belief, this is something that self-destructs for John, because if you go to Sweden, geographically, living in Sweden, growing up there, you're likely to become an atheist. If you grow up in Oregon, the state of Oregon, you're much more likely to be an atheist than if you grew up in Missouri. That doesn't mean that atheism is thereby deconstructed by the fact that it's also tied to geography and culture. Everybody is raised within a belief system, and you can't help but be raised from a particular view of the world. The challenge is to develop belief virtues that will help you to engage with others in a reasonable and fair manner so that you can be critical about your own beliefs and the beliefs of others.
Well, the problem is that atheists also have to take a test, a self-diagnostic test, if they were raised as atheists. I don't deny that. I think that people who are born in Sweden or Denmark who are raised as atheists should test what they were raised with and ask themselves whether or not there is a religion that's true. So I say that atheists who are raised as atheists should investigate to see which religion is true, if there is one, too. So I admit that, because you can be raised wrong all too often. I just say that they should test them all the same. I mean, that's all it is. When they go about doing this, they should test Hinduism and Christianity and Orthodox Judaism by the same standards, you see. So there's nothing different when it applies to the atheists. And usually when it comes to those societies like Denmark and Sweden, there's a lot of societal health there, as Phil Zuckerman has documented. Atheism is what people have when there's a lot of, when there's a healthy society,
Well, I would prefer to look at the social programs, in especially being a Canadian, that one has in Scandinavia as being a sign of social health. But I want to challenge John here. He says, well, okay, if you were raised an atheist, you have to apply the outsider test. Yeah, but what if you were raised a Christian in a very abusive Christian home, and then you reject Christianity, you say, I hate Christianity, there is no God. Does that mean that you don't have to critically introspect your beliefs? Does that mean that you're necessarily rational because you rejected the belief system you grew up in? You can still be irrational. So that's my first problem. My second problem is John repeatedly talks as if this outsider test is some sort of diagnostic test that you can take on the internet, do it once, and then if you pass, you're fine. But the fact is, we need all the time to be exercising and pursuing epistemic virtues to critically evaluate and introspect our own beliefs.
I mean, the question raises for me at this point, Randall, as you say, when it comes to us, you've made it your project to try and investigate the Christian faith and make sure that it does make sense and that you are working through issues. And for you, you've come to the conclusion, having weighed it against atheism and other belief systems, that it holds water, that it is the best explanation for the world we find ourselves in. Is that a purely intellectual process, though? Surely at some level, your personal experience, religious experience, is going to make a difference as to whether you come down on believing that your worldview is the correct one, right?
Most definitely. And that's this, again, the same for everybody. We are socially networked, socially embedded beings. So our social environment, our friends, our family, the social expectations placed upon us, our desire to please others, our hopes and fears, all of these things feed into the types of beliefs we hold and how we hold those beliefs. And I think trying to reduce any of these issues simply to some rational evaluation of evidence is grossly reductive and even delusional.
Well, there's no other way. I mean, I grant everything he just said, that we are, in many times, as I describe it, irrational. How can basically irrational people who use motivated reasoning, how can they actually, objectively test whether their religious faith is true, or their politics or their morals, for that matter? And it seems like to me, one way to get them thinking along these lines is to, consider how they treat the beliefs that they disagree with. I don't care what the beliefs are that they disagree with. How do you treat those beliefs? Well, I treat them with a bit of skepticism. Oh, really? Well, then why don't you apply that to your own faith or to your own morals or to your own politics? I understand that that's the only way to help people, or wake them up, if you will, is to consider that they're wrong. You can't just say to them, hey, you need more critical thinking. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying let's apply the same standards. No double standards, no hypocritical methods. And see what you get. And when I look at that way, I just can't believe it all. I just don't see any enough evidence to believe in any of them.
But you don't feel, as Randall has suggested, that there is a need to apply this outsider test for faith to an atheistic, naturalistic worldview, because you see that as fundamentally different to a faith belief.
Well, there's several reasons about that, and there's. These are disputed, things, but I think they're sure things. And that is, the atheist isn't affirming anything. I mean, we're not claiming anybody levitated. We're not claiming anybody got healed in the River Ganges. We're not claiming that Mormon underwear is magical and protects you from anything. We're just saying, we don't see enough sufficient evidence to agree, to those propositions, And so when it comes to those kind of things, I mean, we're typical of the outsiders. That's what it is. We're typically the outsider.
The kind of issues that Randall was raising about how an atheist can account for the existence of objective values, transcendent virtues, how an atheist can account, I guess, another issue that's often brought up, for the existence of the universe, where it came from, and all those kinds of issues that for a Christian, God is a good, sufficient explanation for, obviously can't be allowed within an atheistic framework, a naturalistic framework. And so is this not a problem? Randall was referencing the work of Thomas Nagel earlier, Mind and Cosmos. He seems to have moved in the direction of realizing that there are some fundamental difficulties with a naturalistic worldview. Now, are you simply saying there aren't any difficulties for a naturalistic worldview, that it doesn't have to be viewed skeptically in the way that other religious belief systems have to be?
Well, first off, worldviews are separate from your views on religion. And that's a misnomer, and it's really hard to communicate. And then one way we can test whether or not worldviews are synonymous with a religious faith or the denial of religious faith is to ask people, ask atheists, for instance, on one hand, or ask believers on the other, who believe all the same things doctrinally, or as an atheist they don't believe at all. Ask either group, what do you think about politics? What do you think about morality? What do you think about gender differences? can you really consider the fact that a man born in Kentucky who is a Christian would think the same as a woman who is born and raised in New York City? They'll have, to say that the worldviews are synonymous with religious faith is really wrong-headed, because there's a host of other kinds of beliefs even Christians have that others Christians don't have because of their color, their gender, their life experiences, whether they're born in the southern hemisphere. Or whether they're born in, England. So they have some kind of maybe shared views about things, but the worldview is absolutely larger than that. And you can extract the religious faith from a worldview and still have a largely same kind of a worldview. That's my argument. So I don't find anyone asking that we need to evaluate our whole worldview with this test. It's just but we need to examine everything that we do believe. That's true. But we need to have some way to solve the problem for religious diversity. And so to expand this and say, well, you know what, we got to, test the worldview or morality or politics with it and all this kind of stuff and try to find out some kind of fault with it or something. Look, we've got a problem here. Religious diversity. How do you propose to solve it?
Yeah, I'll just jump in quickly. I agree that worldview is not synonymous with religion. Thomas Aquinas and me have the same religion. We clearly differ in significant respects in worldview. He was a 13th century Thomist Dominican. I'm a 21st century Baptist Canadian. And then there are some significant differences in terms of our understanding of science, of ethics, of politics, and other issues. Nonetheless, I think the main point, Justin, that you presented, John, is just not wanting to answer. And that's the issue of naturalism is a worldview, and why isn't naturalism as a worldview subjected to the same kind of critical scrutiny that John is advocating other belief systems or religions or worldviews be subjected to? Because I do think that worldviews, and not just quote-unquote religions, should be subjected to the kind of rational critical evaluation that John is proposing, but apparently wants to limit only to what he calls religion.
We're going to move on to another subject, gentlemen, because we've talked a little bit about the main subject of John's book that was published earlier this year, The Outsider Test for Faith, How to Know Which Religion is True. As I've mentioned, it's some of the stuff we've already been talking about gets covered in some of these 20 short debates between John and yourself, Randall, in your latest book, God or Godless, One Atheist, One Christian, 20 Controversial Questions. Let's talk about one. I mean, there's so many fascinating issues that get covered in here in sort of bite-sized way by you both. We've already talked a little bit about the idea that everybody has faith. You've made the case, Randall, that there is faith involved in a naturalistic worldview as much as other types of faith. One though that really caught my attention here had the title, God Best Explains Miracles in People's Lives. Now, I know that in apologetics, the miraculous doesn't tend to get dealt with all that often. It's probably seen as a bit of a minefield in terms of obviously often being something that's reliant on anecdotal stories and that kind of thing. Though we did last year have a very interesting couple of programs with Craig Keener, who'd written a couple of large volumes on miracles, both today and in the Bible. Just give us a little outline of what you're attempting to do in your opening statement in the book on this question of whether God best explains miracles in people's lives, Randall, and then we'll have John respond.
Yeah, actually, let me begin with a story that comes out of Unbelievable. So Michael Shermer was on your show a few years ago, and he was asked, I forget the other gentleman on who had reported having been healed of an illness, but that gentleman challenged Michael Shermer, who's the skeptic. What would it take to convince you that there had been a miracle? And Michael Shermer said, well, if somebody was prayed for and their limb grew back immediately after, that would persuade me that there had been a miracle. And then he thought about it, and he later on in your show, he retracted that and said, actually, I wouldn't think that was a miracle. I would probably conclude that was simply the body's natural ability to regenerate itself. Now, that's pretty revealing to me. It shows to me that there are some people who, it seems, are pretty strongly averse to ever inferring God's action in the world. And that, to me, can be as irrational or ungrounded as people who find God's divine action every time they find an empty parking space at the shopping mall. So, I mean, that's a caveat. There's a danger here on both sides. Often people will critique the Christian by saying, well, you're just counting the hits when you find answers to prayer or something. There's also a danger of just counting the misses and always screening out the hits as anomalies. So that's my first warning. Now, the second thing, we have to define what we mean by miracle. Well, in Greek, in the original Greek, semeia is just sign. It just means it's a sign of God's action. We bring into it all this baggage as to the assumptions as a miracle is a break in divine, in a natural law or something like that. But we simply have to recognize minimally a miracle is just a sign of God's action on the world. In the chapter, I give the example of Kent Sparks, who's an Old Testament prof and a well-known scholar, very well-respected, and a friend of mine, who had an event where he believed God was confirming to him the adoption of two children. And what I do is I take William Dembski's criteria that he uses for inferring design in the intelligent design argument, and I say we can apply that to events in people's lives if those events meet the criteria of being contingent and being complex and being specified within a context. We can infer that God is providing us with some sort of sign of his action in the world. And so that's the basis of the argument. And in that context, I don't think Christians have to be ashamed or embarrassed about finding God acting in the world, because I think once we begin to look for his action, we can find it in many places.
Okay, yeah. Your response then, John?
You know, I admit miracles are a possibility. I mean, because I could be wrong, see. It's just that, after 40 years of Christianity and my study of it, I become more and more, hardened, against the idea that miracles could happen. I have never seen one. I was a Pentecostal. I talked to a former Pentecostal minister last night, and so I asked him. I said, because he's a Pentecostal, I said, "Have you ever seen a miracle?" He said, "No." And it's like, well, I didn't either, because I used to be a Pentecostal, at least for a couple of years, my earliest, Christian belief. You have all this background knowledge. No miracle here, no miracle here, no miracle here, no miracle here. And along with it, you have all kinds of questions about the Bible. A virgin having a baby, or, you've already concluded that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, and you even see forgeries, doctored up texts and liars for Jesus in the early church. And so with all that as a background, and the barbaric nature of Yahweh in the Old Testament, which we also wrote a chapter on, with all that as a background, it becomes harder and harder as years go by to say, well, I would really, at this point in my life, I would be convinced if I saw a miracle. And I think that's probably what Michael Shermer is getting at. I mean, he's been looking at these issues for a long time, and at this point in his life, he doesn't know what it would take to convince him otherwise. If I saw a strange anomaly, in a religious context of someone saying be healed, I mean, I'd have no idea that the person was healed. I've seen those shows on TV with Benny Hinn and Oral Roberts, and I've talked to people who have been there, and I've talked to people who've also said, well, I was healed, and then all of a sudden they have another, epileptic fit the next day. And we become a little bit hardened to the idea that all of our doubts about the resurrection and the virgin birth in the Bible can be overturned by what? Give me an example of what. And someone says, a miracle. Well, we need it. Clinical studies are the best way to test whether or not a miracle happened.
What you seem to be saying is essentially, John, that you doubt the veracity of many miracle claims, and you don't have experience yourself when you were a Christian of seeing miracles. Is this a strong case, Randall, against the existence of miracles, and therefore whether any particular miracle can be attributed to God?
Well, one really important thing that comes out of what John said is that we recognize the rational evaluation of miracle claims is always person relative. It's always relative to a background set of beliefs and experiences. One person, such as John or Michael Shermer, may have a certain set of experiences which lead them to be very, very skeptical of miracle claims. But that doesn't mean that a Christian theist, somebody who believes God exists, that he is active in the world, when they experience something, it doesn't mean that they are obliged to adopt the same kind of skepticism that John has, because they don't have the same experiences that John has. They don't have the same set of skeptical beliefs. So, I mean, looking for God's action in the world in terms of miracles, this would be a good example of the kind of apologetic argument that maybe, for the most part, isn't something to persuade outsiders, but something to strengthen the faith of those who are already committed to the set of beliefs, that as they recognize they are fully justified in finding God's action in the world, they will begin to do so. You know, William Temple, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, famously said, "All I know is when I stop praying, coincidences stop." And of course, he would put coincidence there in quotation marks, because his point is, what one person calls coincidence, another person can be justified in calling it God's action on the world.
You give at the outset of the chapter that deals with this in the book, God or Godless, an example. You referenced it briefly there, of Kent, a pastor living with his wife Cheryl, and they were trying to adopt a child. And the circumstances, to cut the story short, were such that they gave up, but at that moment they received a call which enabled them to go ahead, and there were various other circumstances which made them believe this was a specifically ordained by God circumstance that allowed them to adopt this daughter into their family. Now, does having enough kind of special aspects to a set of events kind of for you begin to confirm more strongly that this was designed, that there was an intelligent mind behind a particular, because in a way it might not fit exactly the definition of a miracle, which is something that goes against the laws of nature usually, that a very unusual set of circumstances coming together, but for you that does count nonetheless as miraculous if there's a kind of very unusual sort of set of circumstances.
Yes, so those are the criteria in Dembski's design filter of complexity and specification. If an event is complex, there are several elements to the event, and if all those elements are meaningful within a context, then yes, that would be a warrant for finding this as being a sign of God's action. So in Kent Sparks' case, there were several circumstances that came together that made this complex, and all of them were affirming the adoption of two children in a really intriguing and extraordinary way. That would meet the design filter and warrant a theist or a Christian in concluding that God was acting in that situation. Let me just give one other quick comment. Colin Humphreys wrote a book a few years ago called The Miracles of Exodus. He argued for the miracles of Exodus in keeping with the laws of nature. So he gives an example of how, through natural meteorological processes that have been observed, the parting of the Red Sea could be explained through weather patterns. His point wasn't that God didn't do it. His point was that it's God's action, God's miracle, is not about breaking the laws of nature, but it's about certain events coming together at just the right moment, showing that God is active in the world.
For you, though, John, must those kinds of events always be given the naturalistic explanation over a divine explanation?
Well, yeah, I mean, I prefer that explanation. I mean, we've seen so many of those kind of claims that have turned out false when, you know, scrutinized, that I think the presumption of that, you know, there's a natural explanation should be paramount. I don't know that even Randall would disagree with that. You know, he doesn't accept every claim to a miracle, and, you know, he's probably skeptical of a lot of them, but you know, apparently some pass through his filters. And I'm just saying that you know, there's a lot of coincidences that happen. I mean, strange and type of coincidences that, you know, given the number of believers in the world, I'm surprised there aren't more miracle claims. You know, Oprah Winfrey found that later on in life she had a hidden twin sister she never knew. And what are the odds of that? And, you know, who's going to invoke God on that one? Well, it's a miracle. God hid her from Oprah for, you know, whatever, 40 years or so, and all of a sudden revealed her to Oprah, you know, what a miracle or what an extraordinary kind of a experience. Well, those kind of things are going to happen simply because there are a lot of us out there and a lot of the events that take place. We need something more than merely, you know, a rare miracle.
The comeback then, Randall, is simply your claimed design can, in the big scheme of the world, coincidences do happen. Amazing coincidences. But when you flatten out the odds, there will be those amazing coincidences will occur of timing. And that's actually what you're seeing when that the timings for that adoption case all worked out and people bought the same Bible verses to them independently and all these sorts of independent things. It was just a big coincidence.
I think what we see here, if this is in John, and it sounds to be in John's case, a categorical dismissal because it's always going to be coincidence, then I think we're just seeing an example of his dogmatism. Let me draw an analogy with sense perception here. So let's say that Mr. Smith can't pay his rent. He prays. He goes out to his mailbox. He needs $647 to pay his rent. He opens his mailbox. He finds there's $647 there, and nobody knew that he needed the money. Can Mr. Smith conclude that this was a sign of God's action answering the prayer? I think certainly so. Is it possible that the money ended up in his mailbox by chance? A coincidence? Yeah, it's possible. But the fact that that's possible doesn't mean he can't conclude that that was a miracle based on the evidence presented to him. Here's the analogy with sense perception. We sense perceive the world every day, every moment, and yet sometimes we misperceive, we hallucinate. Sense perception can be fallible. We don't become global skeptics about sense perception because sometimes it fails us. Likewise, it is not rational to become global skeptics about miracle claims just because sometimes we can make a mistaken inference to a miracle.
And what about you, John? If you saw a limb grow back, would you do the Michael Shermer thing and say, no, there still has to be a naturalistic explanation because that will always be preferable to a divine explanation? I mean, could you ever be convinced of a miracle is the question.
Yeah, I think I could. I just don't know that it could be. I could conclude Randall's God exists. You know, I could believe in a spiritual reality. I'm not opposed to it, and I think that a limb growing out from an amputee would stun me. I mean, I'm trying to take this hypothetical seriously, of course, but it is a hypothetical because, you know, nobody's ever seen one. Nobody's ever claimed that one of those types of things happened. I mean, all we get is I had back problems and all of a sudden, you know, I can walk again, and then the next day we see him limping. I'm skeptical of a lot of these miracle claims simply because I've seen so many of them turn out to be false or claimed by people who are suffering from a huge amount of confirmation bias and they want to believe. I even heard a girl when I was a Pentecostal who said, you know, I'm healed of epilepsy, but I still have the symptoms. I'm serious. Now, Randall doesn't, you know, he chuckles at that too. I mean, I think that there are a lot of beliefs. There was a believer who claimed that God healed his tire. You know, how did that happen? I'm thinking, how am I supposed to verify that? How am I supposed to verify that the tire inflated? You know, that's the whole problem. And when it comes to Balaam's ass talking, you know, I want to see it. You know, and you just have to, you know, see these sorts of things. You can't take it just by personal testimony. People skew the stories that they tell. And we know that our memories are faulty and we see things based through a filter in the first place. So, you know, I wasn't there to see what happened. I mean, I'm not saying that, I'm just saying that we need to take these stories through a really intense skeptical filter. That's all. And, at the age of 58, I've never seen one. And every story I've heard of turns out to be false or that I can't verify. Most of them I can't verify. So those stories mean nothing to me. But what I do think is that there aren't any miracles in the Bible that I can believe. That, you know, even the stories themselves are fraught with problems. And that's where the basis for that background knowledge comes that Randall speaks of. You know, he apparently believes that, you know, some of these miracles happen. And as I look at the texts themselves and, you know, how the ancients rewrote things and borrowed things, you know, I can't even believe that the stories themselves are worth, you know, taking seriously.
Well, we'll be back continuing this conversation, finishing it off in a moment's time here on Unbelievable. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with your thoughts on today's programme, do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing from you. We'll be hearing some of your feedback at the end of today's programme, and we'll be catching up with the final part of our discussion between John and Randall. So welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley, and we're going to be hearing the final part of our discussion between Christian Randall Rouser and atheist John Loftus. They've been doing some debates recently over in Canada. They're joining me on the programme today to talk about their new joint collaborative project, God or Godless. Back to them in a moment's time. Just another thing to tell you about coming up in a little moment on the show. We're going to be hearing from a former guest of this show, Steve Jeffrey, and he's going to be telling us about a conference coming up in North London. So if you're a London dweller, this may be of interest to you on the subject of death. Not something we often talk about a great deal in social settings, but it's something that Christians need to think about, need to be prepared for. And so The Last Enemy is the name of the conference. Steve will be along shortly to tell us a little bit about that. It's coming up in about 2 weeks' time. Next week on the show, come back and we're discussing apologetics from two different Christian perspectives. I don't know if you're particularly into the, as it were, theology of apologetics, defending the Christian faith. Well, there are two broad camps that are sometimes talked about in apologetics: presuppositional apologetics, or sometimes called covenantal apologetics, and evidential or natural theology, and those kinds of titles are sometimes for another area of apologetics. Now, sometimes these two are set against each other as very different approaches to doing it, and we're going to be having that conversation next week. So it's one for the buffs, if you like, those who are really into the subject and want to kind of dig deeper into kind of the biblical and presuppositions that exist when it comes to what we're doing and when we're having these kinds of dialogues between Christians and atheists. My guest for that will be Kurt Jaros, who was, of course, one of our speakers at Unbelievable, the conference this year, who's going to be putting forward the case for natural theology or evidentialism as an approach to apologetics over and against the presuppositional approach, which will be spoken on by a pretty eminent name in the field, Scott Oliphant from Westminster Theological Seminary in the States. So come back for that, a presuppositional and evidentialist approach to apologetics discussion next week. That should be pretty interesting for those who enjoy that kind of area of discussion. For now, time to get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Randall, it's been a really interesting discussion between you and John today. I'm really glad that you've undertaken to write this book together, God or Godless, and you've been doing some debates recently as well together. Do you find that you're willing to change your view as you debate with someone like John? Do you ever find that there are new insights to be gleaned here that might make you think differently about a subject?
Well, I would like to think that I do change my beliefs over time based upon evidence and critical reflection. I mean, in the last several years, I've changed my views on the nature of biblical atrocities and how to read the Bible with respect to things like the Canaanite genocide, and I've become more acquainted with the range of different ways to read the text. I think it's a sign of intellectual health that we continue to develop and change our beliefs. If I can just come back quickly to John's comments and just mention, Anthony Kenny, the philosopher, gave this definition of reason, where he said, reason is the mean or the balance between skepticism and credulity. It's where being unduly skeptical and being unduly credulous, being too willing to believe something. And all I hear about John doing when he talks about miracles is wanting to talk about being skeptical. But that's not necessarily reasonable. You can be hyper-skeptical and that can be irrational. So I think he should consider Anthony Kenny's definition of reason and try to, when you evaluate miracle claims, find that middle ground between undue skepticism and undue credulity.
I mean, in the end, is your faith, of course, going to be about believing not just on the basis of evidence and facts and intellectual arguments, Randall, but also about personal experience, that you believe you have met in a relationship, the creator of the universe. I mean, in the end, we can't... Apologetics is great, but I guess it has its limits in some ways.
Well, if a person lives in an apologetic bubble and thinks everything is based on reason and evidence, then they are deceived. I mean, most people, most Christians never get to that point of getting into rational arguments and evidence. They simply have experiences. And that's the same, not just with Christians, but with all people. So those are the things that condition us and even form the way we reason. So if you get into this idea where we're like disembodied minds that can just reason about everything and seek evidence for everything, you're going to be deluded. As Pascal said, reason is passional. It's always committed. It's always driven by emotion. And we delude ourselves if we think otherwise.
John, would you be prepared to change your mind on anything, do you think, in the course of doing these kinds of debates and discussions in books?
Well, you know, you're asking me after the fact. I mean, you're asking me at my age and you know, with the degrees I have and the years I've studied, what could happen, you know, now that would change my mind? And given that since I've become an atheist, I have not heard anything that challenges what my conclusions were, then I doubt it very seriously. But that shouldn't be considered, you know, a fault of mine. I mean, after all, think about it. You just have to understand what it takes to leave the faith of a religion that says you're going to go to hell if you get it wrong. Well, in order to leave that faith, then you have to be sure that you're right. I mean, you have to be sure that that faith is not rational. You have to be sure that there's nothing to that faith at all. I mean, if you don't, then if there's a glimmer of hope that perhaps that faith is true, then you might suffer under the consequences of Pascal's wager if you find that, you know, reasonable at the time, you know, as you're in doubt. So I had to conclude that there's just no reasonable way that Christianity could be true because of the threat of hell. So no, I don't see anything that can change my mind now, but I tell you what, I was a believer, I was a budding apologist myself, and you know, I've gone through the arguments and none of them make sense to me. In fact, they're worthless.
Just in conclusion, Randall, what would it take, do you think, for John to change his mind? Do you see someone like John as impervious at this point to any further intellectual arguments and that kind of thing?
I'm probably not in a position to speculate on John's openness to changing his beliefs, except to say that I have to take him at his word. He's pretty convinced that nothing at this point would convince him. So that may very well be the case. And I think that in the New Testament, there's a pretty realistic perspective as well. In the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, of course, when the rich man is suffering, he says, "Send an angel back to warn my brothers." And then Abraham says, "Even if a man should rise from the dead, they would not believe." So, I mean, you know, there's, of course, an acknowledgement that people can have very extraordinary signs if they're resistant to them. If they're resistant to the evidence, then, yeah, they won't change their beliefs.
It's been a fascinating chat with you both. Well done for writing this book together, God or Godless. And you can also, of course, find more details on the website of that and, indeed, The Outsider Test for Faith by John Loftus himself. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with me on the show today. You got up very early in the morning to talk to me, so I really appreciate you doing that. And all the best as you continue this dialogue in the future as well.
Thanks as always, Justin.
Yep, thanks.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks again to both my guests. And as ever, if you'd like to get in touch with your thoughts on what was said today, do get in touch via the email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback in just a moment's time. Well, joining me on the line now is Steve Jeffrey, who's the minister of Emmanuel Church in North London, Emmanuel Evangelical Church. Thank you very much for joining me, Steve.
It's great to be with you, Justin.
Thank you. You're here to tell us about a conference you're running shortly in a couple of weeks' time. Talking about the last enemy, which is, of course, a reference to that biblical reference to death. Tell us a bit about what this is all about.
Yeah, the conference is called The Last Enemy, Wrestling with the Reality of Death. This is a rare opportunity, really, to consider an issue that is vitally important to all of us, but which, as far as I can see, is pretty widely neglected among Christians. Perhaps it's because we don't want to talk about it. We want to have a conference about the subject of death. To be honest, it casts its shadow over the whole of our lives. And all of us know, whether it's every few years or as we get older, every few months, that people close to us either die or are suffering grief or are ill. And they therefore staring death in the face and never know when it's going to come. And one day we all must face death ourselves. And people have all kinds of questions about this. And I've never had an opportunity to teach on this subject in an extended way or even to hear about it. And as a church, we wanted to provide this opportunity for people to consider what death is, what it's for, and so on and so forth, and just to prepare ourselves, really, equip ourselves to serve one another and one day, of course, to face death ourselves.
I guess it is a subject a lot of people avoid talking about during their life. Perhaps a lot of people almost want to deny that it's something that they'll ever have to face. But I guess that is only a case of burying your head in the sand, really, isn't it?
Well, in one sense it is. I mean, at this point, you don't want to be harsh with anybody because it's such a painful subject. I think as Christians, often what we do is, and this is right to do this, the thought of death focuses our thoughts on resurrection, which is the glorious hope for those of us who believe in Christ. And yet at the same time, when you're grieving, there are all kinds of questions that you have. And of course, I mean, most of the people listening to the interview we're doing now, most of us aren't actually grieving at the moment. And so there's a sense in which people tend to think, well, this isn't really for me. This isn't really something I need to deal with. Trouble is, when that moment comes, that's too late. It's too late to start thinking about these questions connected with what death is about, what the Bible teaches about death, when you're actually facing it. Forewarned is forearmed in this case. And I think it will be good for all of us to be better informed about this subject.
So what sort of things will you be talking about to help people to think about this important subject before it's too late, as it were?
Yeah, sure. Well, first we want to explore the experience of death from the biblical perspective. What does the Bible say about what death will actually be like and what it will feel like? And how does the Bible help us to understand the emotions felt by people who are facing death? Then we've got some questions, the kind of questions that people ask all the time. What actually happens when a person dies? When Christians die, do they remain conscious? And what are they conscious of? Will we be with the Lord, or will souls sleep? And how do we prepare for that experience? Then there are questions about why death exists. If Jesus has died and died the death of all of us, then what conceivable good purpose could death have for Christians? Why do Christians die at all, in fact, if God is working in all things for our good? And then there are questions about practical questions about Christian faithfulness. Given that this is what we're facing, given that our lives are finite in this world, what's the best way to face the rest of our lives? What should we do to avoid the extremes that we tend to fall into, either ignoring death or becoming obsessed with death? Of course, there's a movement increasingly with advanced medical technology to avoid death at all costs and avoid aging. How are we supposed to think through these issues as we get older and as those we love get older? And then finally, we're going to be joined by Dr. Rob George, who is a professor of palliative care at King's College Hospital. He's a consultant in palliative care at Guy's and St. Thomas's. And he has spoken widely as a Christian on issues associated with death and dying. And he's going to be speaking to us about some of these issues from a medical perspective, which we're very much looking forward to. And it's going to be helpful, I think, for us to hear from his experience, his long experience of helping people to die well and helping families and loved ones to be with those whom they love as they're dying.
So this conference, not just for theologians and church leaders and that sort of thing, I take it, for everyone?
No, that's right. It's right. I mean, I think it'd be useful for anybody. Anybody who thinks that this is going to be something that they face in their life, which means all of us.
Yes,
clearly, for medical students and ministers, there's a particular relevance for it, but it's certainly not just for specialists, so to speak. This is a conference for all Christians. We welcome children as well. It's a family conference in that sense, although everybody is welcome. It's going to be at church in North London, in Cockfosters, where it's the Welsh Chapel in Cockfosters. It's just down the road from Cockfosters Tube Station on the Piccadilly Line. And you can get booking information from our church website, which I can give you in a moment. Well, I'll give you now. It's northlondonchurch.org/conferences. northlondonchurch.org/conferences. And there's a booking form there online you can fill in.
Great. Well, that's the conference on facing the reality of death, the last enemy. It's happening on Saturday, the 29th of June, in a couple of weeks' time. So if you want to get along, as Steve mentions there, do go to the website northlondonchurch.org/conferences, and that will take you to the information about it, where it is, when it's happening, and so on, what it takes to get there. Steve, thank you very much, and all the very best for the conference.
Thanks, Justin. God bless you all. Bye now.
Lots of emails to read out. Thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch over recent episodes. So let's go back a little while to episodes from slightly longer ago. In particular, Hovan wanted to talk about the Steve Jones and Russell Stannard debate that took place on Steve Jones being the atheist scientist, Russell the Christian scientist, on the Bible. Really enjoyed last week's show, says Hovan, but I wasn't too sure, though, that Russell's comment about the New Testament improving on the Old was a way of recommending Christianity to people from a Jewish background. It could easily suggest there's something defective in the Old Testament that needed to be improved, but the New Testament writers don't say this, as far as I can see. If we look at parts of the Old Testament in isolation, we might draw the conclusion that its picture of God is crude and incomplete. But isn't this failing to see the wood for the trees? Taken as a whole, the Old Testament presents a rounded picture of God and his purposes, and those who have learned to appreciate it will echo the words of Psalm 119. Oh, how I love your law. It is sweeter than honey. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. I believe the Jesus of the Gospels would have said amen to that psalm. He himself says in Matthew 5 that he has come to fulfill, not to improve, the law and the prophets. The public ambassadors of Jesus would be wise to make clear the continuity between the Old and New Testaments. The message of the Old Testament forms the DNA of the New. It's on this basis that we Christians may recommend Jesus to our Jewish friends as their Messiah, as well as ours. Anything less is potentially, at least, a diplomatic bungle, says Hovan in West Sussex. Thank you, Hovan. Yes, and I've had a few similar comments that that perhaps Russell was erring towards a Marcionite view of the Old Testament, wanting to sort of say that was a bad version of God or something. Some people have said made similar comments, but thank you. Interesting to hear from you. Matthew Garrett titles his email, A Few Questions. I'd like to tell you what an absolute blessing listening to your show has been for me since I started listening a few weeks ago. Almost every podcast, I listen to them on my commute to work, has caused deep reflection and led to more investigation that have most certainly deepened the love I have for our beautiful and mysterious God. In my humble opinion, your show wonderfully highlights the plethora of questions and mysteries found in the Christian tradition, but equally illuminates the tremendous answers it provides for the human condition. Thank you, Matthew. Check in the post, obviously, for that lovely commendation of the show. I did have a couple of questions, though. I've recently graduated college and beginning my journey, so I always like to hear how other people began theirs. How did you begin your career with Unbelievable? What advice do you have for engaging in dialogue about very complex and sensitive theological topics? How do you manage to get such spectacular guests? If I'm sure you're busy, no rush to respond. Well, I did, of course, get back to your email here, Matthew, but I thought it'd be interesting to just read that email out. Thank you again for your lovely comments on the show. I did actually do an interview recently, and probably a good time to mention it, with a listener of the show, Nick Peters, who runs his own blog podcast called Deeper Waters. So if you search for that, Deeper Waters, Justin Brierley, Nick Peters, you'll probably find it online. And we had a good hour or so actually chatting about the genesis of the show, how it all started. But to give you the brief story, essentially, I was working in Christian radio and I felt there needed to be a forum for Christians and non-Christians to talk. I Christian radio can be a kind of a bubble. Sometimes Christians talking to Christians about Christian things, and I wanted to, you know, break open that bubble at least a little bit for an hour and a half a week, maybe. And so Unbelievable was born, and the CEO of Premier Radio, Peter Kerridge, said yes, and that was getting on for 8 years ago now, believe it or not. And so that was how it all began. And I think initially there were some concerns from people, Christian listeners, not sure about the idea of letting non-Christians onto a Christian radio station. Don't we have enough secular talk the rest of the week on the secular stations? Well, I think that, I stood by my guns. If Christians believe in the truth of the gospel, in the reliability of scripture, and affirm in their faith, we've got nothing to fear by having conversations, open and honest conversations. And so that's how the show has progressed over the years. As for engaging in dialogue about complex and sensitive theological topics, well, I think that you just have to be honest, courteous, respectful, but be honest about the differences, and choose people who are the best representatives from both sides, I'd say, is the idea. I don't know that I've always lived up to that on the show, but that's the aim anyway. And as for spectacular guests, well, I'm rather fortunate. For those who hear this as a podcast, it shouldn't be forgotten it's also a radio show, and so I'm fortunate to have the opportunity for guests who are passing through doing other maybe shows on other other shows on the radio station. I can grab them, you know. So when we've had Rob Bell in the past, it's obviously because he's doing a number of interviews across a range of shows and that kind of thing, and so he pops into the Unbelievable show, does a recording, and there it is for posterity. But that's the advantage as well, of course, of broadcasting from here, central London. Most of the big names come through at one point or another, which is always good. So thank you, Matthew, for getting in touch. Hope that answers most of your questions to your satisfaction. Normal, Dan, at least in Normal, Illinois. I love the fact that there's a place called Normal in Illinois. says, I stumbled on your podcast looking for podcasts of John Lennox a few weeks ago. Again, he says, I drive a substantial amount for my job and I've had the opportunity to listen to hours and hours of your podcast. You must be getting fed up with the sound of my voice, Dan. I'm hoping to be caught up with current content soon. I did listen to a couple of interviews with Rob Bell, the most recent being with Andrew Wilson. Wow, Andrew Wilson did well. Rob Bell was outmatched in content, foundation and general attitude. I'm watching the video online right now as I type this. I don't see how Rob couldn't watch this video and be embarrassed. He seems to be a product of society and not the Bible, unfortunately. In any case, I appreciate the product you're producing. It's been a conduit for my continual reading selection, having just finished one of John Lennox's books, thanks to the podcast. In the world of sensational media, it's nice to hear a temperate, grounded voice dissecting dissenting views. Thank you very much indeed. And that Rob Bell video has been very popular, actually, on YouTube, something like 72,000 views the last time I looked at it. Obviously, a lot of people with different views as well in the comment section for that one, on that discussion on homosexuality. Here's Joe, who says, thank you for the podcast. I live, again, it's another American listener, live across the pond in the state of Ohio. Always look forward to the podcast every week. Really enjoyed the recent podcast with Guy Consolmagno, a.k.a. the Pope's astronomer. Also was wondering if you've ever heard of a man named Dr. Michael Brown, Reformed Jew, and I believe he would bring some intriguing and enlightening conversation with debates with non-believers on many subjects. He does have his own daily radio show in the US. I do indeed know Dr. Michael Brown. In fact, he has been on the show a couple of times in the past, a long time ago debating Rabbi Botiak Shmuley, who's quite a media sort of rabbi, isn't he, on the whether Jesus was the Messiah. And then not so long ago, discussing with an atheist on the question of whether the Old Testament prophecies of Christ are reliable, given indication that he was the promised Messiah again. Thank you very much. Thanks to all those others who are getting in touch, all kinds of issues here. Here's an interesting one. Godfrey emailed me saying, you discussed recently the question of the theistic persuasion of philosophers as a whole. Here's a recent survey, and you sent me to a online survey, which, apart out of many figures there, said that 73% of philosophers don't believe in God, which is, you know, a fairly high statistic, actually. Though I think if you actually broke that down into philosophers of religion, because at the end of the day, philosophy in all the different aspects that people might specialise in, it may mean that lots of philosophers just have never actually really addressed the key questions regarding the existence of God. So I'd have a question mark over how, you know, what that really tells us, 73% not believing in God. And in fact, it was interesting to see later on in the statistics that, in fact, 50% ascribe to naturalism. So if you're talking about thoroughgoing atheists, apparently only half are. But anyway, interesting to see those results. Thank you for sending them through, Godfrey. I'm pretty sure that's not your actual name, but that's the name you're going by when getting in touch. Thank you anyway. Thank you for listening to the programme today. It's been great to have you with me on another edition of Unbelievable. And we're back again, same time, same place next week.
You're unbelievable.
I'm going to be joined by Kurt Jaros, the founder of Real Clear Apologetics. He's going to be in discussion with Scott Oliphant, who is a key voice in the presuppositional field of apologetics. He's going to be talking about that area, or what sometimes he calls covenantal apologetics. And so they're going to be doing a discussion on whether what is the value of a presuppositional approach to apologetics over evidentialism. If you don't know even what those terms necessarily mean, well, tune in next week. You'll find out. This is one of those in-house debates, but I'll welcome sort of responses from across the board. So come back same time next week for that discussion. Look forward to having you with me for that. In the meantime, thanks for being with me on the show today, and I look forward to seeing you same time, same place next week.